Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Michael B. Hyman presiding, case number 22-1864, People versus Paul Sedlowski.
Good afternoon. I'm Justice Michael Hyman. With me is Justice Carl Anthony Walker and Justice Celia Gamrath. Each side has 20 minutes. We'll conduct this as if we were in the courtroom, which means we may interrupt from time to time. And the appellant has time for rebuttal. Tell us how much time you wish to say for rebuttal.
I would wish to say 5 minutes, Justice Hyman.
All right, thank you. And say your name just so it's on the record.
It's Stephen Brown on behalf of Appellant Paul Zalewski.
Okay, and for the state.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. David Iskowich on behalf of the people with the Cook County State's Attorney.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Brown, you may proceed.
excuse me. I would like to first let the justices know that I will not be addressing the ineffective assistance of counsel argument today. I'm going to focus on the other four. If you have any questions, I'm glad to answer them, but don't wait for it, I guess. The first argument I'd like to make is that Detective Ryan, a witness in this case, his testimony was impermissible lay witness opinion testimony that violated Rule 701B of the Illinois Rules of Evidence. Specifically, the testimony in question relates to him narrating over certain surveillance footage, the Monty surveillance
But
footage,
the
which
judge put on certain parameters, and he did abide by those parameters, didn't he?
I would disagree that he did. He did generally abide by those parameters. He generally kept his testimony to the most general terms, things that were obvious that any juror could have seen, and they were only included because it was a long video and frankly boring. So I could understand the trial court's interest in keeping the jury on task. However, the specific testimony in question was not an obvious observation. It was an inference that he drew from.
But what was the inferences? For example, give us specific.
Okay, in this case, the Jeep, which is the subject of all this, there's a Jeep in a parking lot. It has a static reflection of a light off of its back window, which is to
Well,
say its back.
that's what your expert said. But there's a light. Did he
So
didn't call it. What did he call it?
he said there are flashes of light, but I want to be clear that the light, there was a light there before, and that light then pulsed or flashed brighter. So this is what we're talking about. And from his testimony, we can see it's truly not something that a lay witness could know. You could not state that as an observation, and I don't believe that the expert stated it as an observation. It was only after hours and hours of careful analysis using specialized equipment that he was able to determine that it was not, didn't originate from within the vehicle.
Well, he didn't. In going through that, he did. He said he placed it where to look. Isn't that what he did? He
He
didn't
did,
characterize it
Your
other
Honor,
than the flash. I mean,
I
that's what he said. I'm just looking at the record.
he did place it in time, yes, but he also stated that it came from within the passenger compartment of the vehicle. It wasn't merely that there's a brightening in the reflection on the side window of the Jeep. No, in fact, what he said was that it came from within the Jeep, which is an inference he made based on his assumption that it was a muzzle flash.
Well, he didn't say muzzle flash.
He did not.
He did
Sorry.
not.
You're correct. He did not say muzzle flash, but the coding was clear enough that the state, in presenting its closing argument, did not feel the need to even draw that deduction for the jury, even though it was permitted to do so. It could have said, they could have said, and here you can see muzzle flashes inside this Jeep. They replayed this section twice. They went back, did kind of a slow-mo, here it is again, and they did not think that it was unclear. Muzzle or flashes of light were unclear when they meant to say
But
muzzle
wasn't
flash.
that a decision for the jury to make? And so that if they didn't slow it down and he didn't make a reference to it, nobody would know what your expert was talking about.
Indeed, the expert may never have been called if this
Well, you
testimony
had
had
planned it
been.
beforehand, so
Excuse me?
you had an expert ready to testify.
There was an expert ready to testify, correct. And he did, in fact, testify. That is also true.
But Mr. Brown, isn't it correct, though, that Officer Ryan never identified Mr. Zalowski in any parts of the video? So doesn't that kind of take it outside of a 701?
Justice Walker, that's true. He did not identify Zalewski, but his testimony doesn't have to be an identification in order for Rule 701 to kick in. And the Supreme Court case, Frieding Skoke Roloff Inc. versus Hamilton's 1985 case, which I cited to in my briefs, speaks to opinion testimony that is not involving an identification. It was, in that case, a man opining about the inevitability of a car crash. And the Supreme Court in that case found that because it was not helpful to the jury, or the jury could come to that conclusion on their own, that it was invading the province of the jury and usurping their function as a finder of fact. It was, like here, planting a seed in the minds of the jury that something was or wasn't true that wasn't based on fact, that was based on an interpretation of events.
But
Even here,
here,
though.
the judge specifically said that this would be helpful to the jury. And doesn't the judge get a lot of discretion to make that finding?
The judge does get discretion for those sorts of things. However, I believe this snuck under the radar. I believe this was something that the judge did not intend to come out based on his ruling prior to that. He specifically stated that he didn't want any testimony as to the specifics of what occurred, which is to say that he didn't want to see have hear testimony that someone is going into a car doing something, which my interpretation of that is that he doesn't want anything more than an indication that something's happening at that moment.
Well,
There's
isn't that what he was doing by saying that there is that light?
Excuse me?
That's what he was doing, wasn't it, when he referenced the light?
In that case, in fact, trial counsel for my client objected numerous times to any narration over top any of the videos.
He had a continuing objection, I understand.
Continuing objection, and the sidebar in question was before this specific testimony was elicited. It was just trial counsel had an issue with any narration at all, which is to say, saying, here's a car pulling in, here's another car pulling in, here's a
We
person getting
understand it. We understand
in. Okay.
it. No, we're not arguing that he didn't preserve the objection.
And here the jury was free to re reject or disregard any of that testimony that as he went through the video. So as they are with any other witness. So what I'm just not sure that this actually falls under 701.
Justice Walker, in my response to you is that while the jury does have the ability to disregard any evidence that it hears, it's still the court's duty to ensure that only pr the proper evidence gets in front of them in the first place. It's the reason that we exclude any evidence at all. And in this case, based on the reading, the holding and Frieding, as well as the Fifth District holding People versus Sykes, this shouldn't have occurred because Detective Ryan hadn't done had no additional insight into this in, this video other than having watched it himself, and that's something that the jury was perfectly capable of doing on its own.
And you realize, though, that in the and you, because you've agreed in your brief that the standard of review here is abuse of discretion, and we kind of give the judges pretty give them somewhat we give them deference, probably more deference than other standards. Do you tell us how, in what way you believe the judge abused the judge's discretion?
Well, I believe Judge Cataldo abused his discretion in that his ruling went, or the whether or not he intended, that was his intention in his ruling. The actual testimony itself was clearly controverted the holding in People versus Sykes, which is a great, in this case, persuasive holding, wherein a witness testified over a video, and all they'd done before is watched a better quality version of that video. And the court found that because they did not have any, there was no aspect of their testimony could not have been communicated to the jury effectively, that their testimony was invading the province of the jury, that they this testimony was duplicative of what the jury could have done, and it did it in the place of the jury. And that's why we feel it planted this seed in the mind of the jurors that resulted in my client's guilty verdict.
Let me ask you. I know you said there were three issues. You were going to talk about the other issues, not the ineffectiveness issue. But of all the issues, what is the most important? What is the one that you think is the home run here? Is it this issue or is it another issue?
It's this issue, also the quashing of the search warrant is, I think, another very important issue for this court to
So
address.
you think? I mean, if you were going to win this case, the issue that really wins it for you is which the Ryan
I
or
had believed it was this issue, Justice Hyman.
okay. I just want to make sure because you went with it first. I wanted to see if that was your.
Yes.
And so
And I.
you don't believe that the fact that there was no evidence, no physical evidence that he's connecting Mr. Zaloski to this crime, that's not, that doesn't weigh as heavy? Is that what you're saying?
I believe that that's an important aspect of whether or not this was a prejudicial error on the part of the court. The fact that the evidence was closely balanced in this case shows that this error resulted in prejudice to my client. I think that all of the evidence or lack thereof supplied by the state is of critical importance in the court's determination, and that it needs to be considered, especially in conjunction with these other arguments.
You come to the conclusion it's closely balanced.
I have, yes, it is closely
I
balanced.
know. How do you come to that conclusion?
Well, Your Honor, there are several sort of dangling strings, leads. What am I trying to say? There's some unresolved issues in this case. Specifically, there's complete lack of physical evidence connecting my client
It's not
himself.
it. It's a circumstantial case, but just to cut through it, we have cell phone data,
Correct.
ballistics evidence, evidence that Zaloski and Esquivel had a relationship. The bag of marijuana from Zaloski's car resembled that found in Esquivel's apartment. We have the testimony of the employees at Edison that Zaloski wanted gloves, gasoline, and rags hours before Esquivel was seen murdered. We know that there's video showing traffic camera footage from surrounding businesses that was admitted in the smell of gasoline at the fire of the car. And there's how is this a close?
Case because one, because there's evidence that this did not occur as the prosecution claimed it did. For
Wasn't
one,
that for the jury to decide?
that it's for the jury to decide, correct. But in this case, it was against the manifest weight of the evidence.
No, but that doesn't go. You said it's a close case. I'm trying to figure out how it's close, considering all the circumstantial evidence in this case. I mean, we have photographs. If the jury believed that the man going back and forth from the auto shop to the cars and then driving and then the phone, we know that the murder victim's phone was traveling along with same route, and they had phone calls, and I mean, there seems to be a lot of circumstantial evidence here that somebody could use. Again, close cases. How do you define a close case?
I define a close case as one where there is some evidence connected to my client, but there's also ample evidence that suggests my client did not commit this crime. And I'm speaking to the fact that there's no blood spatter on my client after allegedly shooting Esquivel from a foot away. There's no he's wearing he goes he gets white gloves that are knit white gloves, goes back into the Jeep, and also, those, there's no blood on those when he subsequently appears in Addison Auto. Excuse me. So sorry. I'm speaking about the bullet casings. There were 4 to 6 shots supposedly shot, and only 2 casings were found, or 3 total were found, and was suggesting that there he existed somewhere else. The police did an
But they
extensive.
did match. They did match.
They did match. That's
They did
correct.
match. They were found in his home. They were found in his home in the basement.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I'm out of time now. If you'd like me to continue, I can, but
You have your 5 minutes. That's fine if you want to. And unless
I'll.
anybody has any questions. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
State.
Thank you again, Your Honors. Mr. Brown, may it please the court. On issue one, I think the court hit on, through its questioning to my able opponent, some of the highlights of the evidence and the law in this matter. As an initial matter, I think it bears repeating that Detective Ryan not once ever testified that the flashes of lights were muzzle flashes, or that they were the result of a discharge of a firearm. He simply said that upon entering the vehicle, he saw what appeared to be flashes of light emanating from inside the vehicle. In addition, as Justice Hyman pointed out, his testimony on these points was quite limited. He was not allowed to identify the defendant. He was not allowed to identify the defendant's vehicle. He was not allowed to say that this was a drug deal, that this was even a crime scene. And so his testimony should be viewed under Rule 701 within that really narrow context, factual context.
But isn't it
Now,
correct that he was in no better position to
sure.
determine what's in the video than the jury would have been? The jury could have just watched the video without him narrating it.
I understand your question, Your Honor. I think I would, in response, I would turn the court's attention to the Thompson case, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case cited in the briefs extensively. From 2017. That case dealt with lay opinion identification testimony. And the court held in that case that when a witness testifies as to the identity of a person seen in that kind of footage, there have to be some additional safeguards to ensure that the court and the trier of fact and the parties have some assurance that the witness who's making that identification is in a better position than the jurors to make that identification through his or her, for instance, prior familiarity with the person being identified. Now, there is an exception to that. It's important, so I'll point the court specifically to paragraph 61 of that case. There was a witness in that case who testified that he viewed for surveillance footage and said that he only identified the subject in that video. He didn't identify the defendant in the video. He only said the subject appears to be doing this or that. The court said that under those circumstances, no additional assurances are necessary to show that the witness has a better idea or a better understanding or a better ability to make the identification as the jury, because no identification is made. So the defendant relies much upon the idea that Detective Ryan had to have be in some better position than the jury to make this, to provide this testimony. But that exception is carved out in Thompson. And so he
But
did not need to be in a better position.
isn't Ryan in a better position? Because unlike the Thompson case, he is a police officer. And as a police officer, isn't his testimony going to have greater impact?
Sure, I understand your question, Your Honor. This goes to one of the defendant's points. So I think that, again, we need to look at what he testified to. He did not testify that as a police officer, I can tell you for sure, or I have a reasonable probability of believing that in my experience with firearms, this was the flashes of light represented something like muzzle flashes. He didn't even say they represented something any untoward. Police officers, as your honors know, testify all the time about ex with respect to exhibits. The inference, and I did do disagree with the my opponent on this point that he drew an inference in this respect. He didn't draw an inference. He only made a statement of opinion or fact, however you want to characterize it. And the jury was left with the wide discretion to decide whether to disregard that point, or to believe maybe part of it, or to believe the defendant's expert even. So I understand the defendant's concern that his capacity in testifying as a police officer draws some concern, but it doesn't draw enough concern to say that his overall account or this particular piece of testimony in particular was problematic under 701. The cases he did cite in this respect, I think the SEPCA case and goodness, another case, they're from the 1970s. They're older cases, and I think that they're
Well,
plainly
but
distinguishable.
you also agree that Detective Ryan's status as a law enforcement officer also compounds any prejudice that there might be in terms of his walking them through the video.
Your Honor, I don't know if I agree with that entirely. The jury was free to disregard his testimony, whether as a police officer they might not have believed him as much as a police officer. We don't know that. I don't think there's any compounding here where the nature of this testimony was really de minimis and was not responsive to any ultimate question of fact. It was merely an observation he made in his viewing of the video. Now, to Justice Hyman's question about being in a better position, if we do believe that he needed to be in a better position to point this out to the jury, that's also been satisfied here. The jury, recall, was watching this footage. And just to clarify, this is exhibit three. There's a lot of exhibits in this case. This is 375, which is a shortened version of exhibits 32 and 33. Now, exhibit 32 is Monte Camera 4 looking westbound down the drive. Monte 10 is kind of looking in a southwesterly direction. So the jury was looking at exhibit 375, which took the shortened portions of 32 and 33 and put them up. What the state did is they put them up on like a split screen. And these were time-stamped and date-stamped, and they were also motion-activated, and they played at the same time. So what the jury, and I looked at these in my office for hours and hours, and you have to, you're watching both screens, and you're trying to see when the motion activation is working and when it's not. And sometimes one camera is still because there's no motion, and there's some motion on the other camera. They all do sync chronologically in the end. So Detective Ryan had the benefit that the jury didn't have of leading the investigation, securing this evidence, and then watching it, obviously, before the state presented its case in chief. So he was in a better position having observed the video already, having some familiarity with the layout of the geography, and having a better understanding of what the Monte cameras were capturing. And he did not testify to any of the as I noted, he did not testify that these were crimes being committed or that there were muzzle flashes representing a firearm being discharged. He simply pointed out that he saw what appeared to be flashes of light and other instances where there was movement.
But
So,
which you can see, I'm sorry, just a
no,
second.
go ahead.
Which
Which you do concede in your brief, though, that identification of the Jeep was error.
I do, yes, Your Honor. That went against the court's ruling that the witness should not identify people or vehicles. And
Right, and you've heard me address Mr. Brown earlier. He didn't identify the officer, but he identified the vehicle, and we all agree that that's error.
I have no choice but to say that that's error, as it was characterized as error in the court below. And it was the victim's Jeep, actually, that he identified very early in his testimony. He said that that's Esquivel's Jeep. The defense promptly and properly objected because it went against the court's pretrial order in that respect. The objection was sustained. And it's well settled that a prompt objection, a sustaining of the objection, and a proper instruction to the jury to disregard the comment, which is what occurred here, is on balance adequate to forestall any notion that it's reversible error. And we also do believe that on merits aside, we have a very strong case for harmless error in this respect. Just a few points on that. First, again, Detective Ryan did not testify these were muzzle flashes. He only testified they were flashes of light. And the defendant actually called his own expert who testified, an actual expert on lighting and lighting technology and lighting reflectiveness, who testified at length that in his expert opinion, the lights were not coming from inside the vehicle, but were simply reflections from passing traffic or the door opening or the street lights in the area caused by other movement of other vehicles. So the jury had two versions of what happened here and had the discretion as the trier of fact to decide which to believe. In fact, the jury could have disbelieved Detective Ryan on this point and believed the defense expert and still concluded that the evidence was strong enough to convict. Or it could have believed that neither the expert nor Detective Ryan were making any sense on any of these points, and it was quite irrelevant given the balance of the evidence. To the extent that the defendant is challenging this part of the testimony on the basis that the shooting didn't occur inside the vehicle, we have very strong evidence suggesting that it did occur inside the vehicle because investigators found actual shell casings inside the vehicle. Also, the positioning of the body is important in this respect for purposes of determining where the shooting occurred. According to the record, the body, when it was discovered at midnight burning at Cinnamon Cove, it was positioned in a very unusual way. The body wasn't sitting in the driver's seat. The head of Mr. Esquivel's body was positioned on the floorboard, passenger side floorboard. His mid-body was along the console of the car, and his feet were kind of like sticking into the back of the car. Now, to believe that he was shot at Cinnamon Cove, where the car ended up, one would have to believe that after he was shot, the shooter moved his body in this very odd position and then set the car on fire. It's implausible. What the more plausible version, which was presented to the jury, is that the victim was shot inside the vehicle, given the shell casings inside the vehicle. And then in order to take that car away from the site of the shooting, because recall, the defendant was positively identified at that time at the scene of the shooting by the three employees of the Addison Body Shop. He felt the need to move the car somewhere else to get rid of the evidence. And in doing so, he needed to move that body in that position. So those two pieces of evidence, the positioning of the body and the shell casings in the vehicle, strongly support the theory that the defendant shot the victim in the car at that time and then moved the car to the Cinnamon
Cove. What about
the
lack of blood on the white gloves and that he didn't have blood on him?
Sure, Your Honor. So that goes to his sufficiency challenge, of course. And we all know the standard. We're all very familiar with that standard of viewing it in the light most favorable to prosecution. Could any rational trier fact found beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of the offense? The lack of physical evidence in a case is black letter law that's not a determinator under the Jackson standard. The fact that there was no blood on his clothing or on any gloves or any other evidence, we are not supposed to take these facts and raise them to the level of reasonable doubt. In fact, looking at this evidence in a light most favorable to the prosecution, as I outlined in my brief, one could surmise that he cleaned the blood off of his sweatshirt or threw his sweatshirt away. Blood splatter in the vehicle, the lack of blood splatter on his clothes might be attributable to a shooting that didn't produce blood splatter in his direction. The car, recall, was burnt quite extensively, and that would have removed any further blood staining from the vehicle. They did find pools of blood on the floor. But to the extent there was not evidence of blood splatter, it doesn't dilute the state's case, especially given the balance of the other evidence, including the extensive video footage, including the compilation video, which succinctly put together the chronology of these events. The defendant was positively identified at the Addison Body Shop at the very time that the Esquivel and the defendant met there. The ballistics evidence is, just as Hyman pointed out, that it was discovered in the basement of defendant's home, was an exact match to the shell casings that were found in the vehicle. The defendant's girlfriend testified that he left his apartment at 9:30 p.m. on the night of the murder. We have a phone call from Esquivel to the defendant about 9:58 p.m. According to the videos, they rendezvoused on Addison Court about 10:02. The theory is that the defendant entered the vehicle, shot the victim about 10:13. Around this point, he went into the body shop to retrieve. He actually went in there three times to get his drug bag, a bottle of water, rags, gloves, and gasoline. Eyewitness testimony of the three employees at the Addison Body Shop confirmed that the defendant was there between 10 and 10:30. They actually not only identified defendant there, but they also said that the defendant was there in his white Chevy Impala. In addition, well, I think that should suffice for the balance of evidence on the sufficiency challenge, and viewing that in a light most favorable to the state, any rational trier of fact could have found him guilty on this very strong circumstantial case. And I like to think of the evidence in this case less as like links in a chain and more like strands of a rope that intertwine. We have a lot of this evidence between the eyewitnesses, the video, the ballistics, the cell phone. It all intertwines to make a very, very strong and powerful case against the defendant.
Are there any other questions?
Just one question. You talked about Thompson and those additional safeguards. I
Sure,
know that
Your
you don't think that those were necessary, but what would be a sampling of those additional safeguards or assurances?
Sure, Your Honor. So in Thompson, the court said that if a law enforcement, so there's two sets of safeguards. The first set of safeguards is for a non-law enforcement officer. Before a non-law enforcement officer identifies a person in a footage like this, the state needs to elicit testimony that this person had some familiarity with the defendant. It's not a very rigorous burden, but there's a four or five examples of how this person might have familiarity from prior contacts, prior knowledge, acquaintances, etc. And then there's a second category of safeguards that apply to law enforcement officers only. And those safeguards entail what the court suggested, or that they didn't suggest. They instructed that before a law enforcement officer testifies to that, the court should probably, in most cases, hold a hearing outside the presence of the jury to ascertain the nature of those contacts and familiarity. The reason for that is because a lot of those prior contacts and familiarity with the defendant may entail overly prejudicial facts concerning prior contacts in the law enforcement and criminal context. So those are the two types of safeguards: law enforcement and non-law enforcement. However, as I noted earlier in my argument, there was no identification here, and so neither of those safeguards was necessary. Before I close out, Your Honor, I just want to mention I did make one mistake in my brief. I want to point the court to it's on page 19 of my brief, and I cited to Thompson. This goes to issue one. And I just did a quick parenthetical to Thompson where I said that when the law enforcement officer does not identify the defendant, but only as the subject, as occurred in Thompson, this was not identification testimony subject to the criteria in Rule 701. That is actually not correct. It is subject to Rule 701. What it's not subject to are these additional safeguards. That's what I meant to say there. And to the extent the court has any questions about that part of my brief, that was a mistake. I just wanted to point that out. Unless the court has any further questions, we request that the court Affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for making that known to us, the correction. Appreciate it. Mr. Brown?
There's a few issues I'd like to respond to from counsel's argument. The first is that Thompson excuses any additional caution here because there's no identification. We're talking about two separate parallel lines of law here. One of them is about opinion testimony, and the other one is opinion identification testimony. In this case, we have opinion testimony, which has been and continues to be subject to the requirement that it be helpful and that helpfulness arrives from the witness being in a position where they're unable to explain the basis of the facts that they're testifying to or the basis of their opinion that they're testifying to. And here again, there was no basis beyond watching the video. And so this court should call People versus Sykes in determining whether this was error or not. And it's important we do so because this was not a de minimis error, as counsel suggested. It was ultimately, though indirectly, a opinion as to the ultimate issues in this case. As counsel so clearly pointed out, the entire case is circumstantial and it involves placing Zalewski and Esquivel at Addison Auto and the murder actually taking place there. If there were no gunshots, if the murder did not take place at Addison Auto, then there is no evidence that the appellant did this crime, committed this crime. So it's far from harmless, it's far from de minimis. This is actually quite an important opinion that was put out there, and it had a very potentially profound effect on the jury. As to the counsel's argument that Detective Ryan had gone through an entire investigation, well, that's Ryan's own fact finding. That is him acting as his in his role as an investigator for the purpose of prosecuting crimes. He had done the fact that he had done his own fact finding on this should be all the more reason to not trust his opinion and to see that his opinion, in fact, was just that, an opinion. It was not an observation of fact. It was colored by his own expectations and the rest of the information that he himself had weighed, and not the jury. Finally, as for the specifics of the state's case, I don't know if this was in my brief or if it was implied somewhere, either of the briefs, but we're not arguing that the murder didn't take place in the Jeep. We're arguing that the Jeep was not necessarily at Addison Auto when the murder took place, and my client wasn't in the Jeep when the murder took place. And this is something that is important because when we're talking about blood stains, we're talking about trace evidence, we're not talking about the Jeep. We're talking about, because of course there's going to be blood in the Jeep. What we're talking about is in my client's car, the car that my client drove, which belonged to his mother. They took that car apart piece by piece and they looked for any trace that they might find. And, the video in question shows him going between the Jeep and his car at least once. And, he ultimately drives away in his mother's car. And it doesn't make sense that there would not be any blood or any kind of other evidence, physical evidence in that car. When there by all rights should be. There was so much blood in the vehicle at the time it was found in Lemon Cove. After the fire department had hosed it down, the water inside was still red. So it's beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a reasonable doubt that my client did not commit this crime. Additionally, excuse me. Window not being still intact when the Jeep left Cinnamon Cove makes it very unlikely that a gun was fired within that Jeep. The fact that the window was gone at some point and that three bullet casing bullets were found within the Jeep itself suggests that the window was destroyed by a bullet. And the fact that there was no remnants of any window at Cinnamon Cove where the fire occurred, and there was no remnants of a window at Addison Auto. And in fact, looking at the videos presented by the state, entered into evidence, you can see that driver's side window flashes, reflecting a street light as it leaves Addison Auto, only to eventually arrive at Cinnamon Cove. If there are no more questions, appellant would like to just urge this court to reverse the trial court's holding and remand this case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both of you for your excellent arguments and your briefs. We'll take the case under advisement and be deciding and as soon as we can. So I appreciate it. Have a good holiday to both of you and have a good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Thank
Thank
you.
you.